This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with activist Margaret Kimberly about her new book, Prejudential.
This is a magnificent short book, a great hidden history, something that Howard Zinn would have loved.
Every year, before they reach the age of 18, 12 million girls are forced into marriage.
Listen in to the executive director of Unchained at Last to learn the truth about this horrific societal scandal.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
America was settled and set up as a slave-owning country. When it broke free of England, it was finally able to expand westward across the Appalachian Mountains, committing genocide against the Native American population. This is the sordid and hidden root history that truth-telling historians have revealed to us. In her new book, Prejudential, Black America and the Presidents, author Margaret Kimberly explores America's relationship with race through the lens of the presidents who have been chosen to represent all the people. She has written that this book is an effort to shed light on the truth, to the extent that our leaders embody aspects of who we are as a people, studying how each president has participated in our nation's complicated and often shameful treatment of black people is a good place as any to start. 10 of the 12 initial presidents of the USA were slave owners. Andrew Jackson, whose picture graces our $20 bill, was an Indian killer. Lincoln was never an abolitionist. He wanted America for white people only and had a plan to send the formerly enslaved out of the country. One such plan briefly came to fruition in Haiti. What about Presidents Roosevelt, Johnson, Clinton, and Obama? Were they more sympathetic to the interests of black Americans? We speak today with Margaret Kimberly, a New York-based writer and activist. She's been an editor and senior columnist for Black Agenda Report since its inception in 2006. She is a contributor to the anthology In Defense of Julian Assange. Margaret Kimberly, congratulations on writing Prejudential, and welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on the launch of your new book, Prejudential. Can you please explain the title for our listeners and talk about the genesis of your book?
Sure. I can't take credit for the title. It was something the publisher thought of. My working title was Black America and the Presidents, but they felt incorrectly so that we needed to have something that was frankly catchier and something that summed up what I was trying to achieve with the book. So prejudicial, a new word, I guess it hopefully will be in the Urban Dictionary. The idea behind choosing that word was to state the history, the presidency in Black America is a long history of racist acts and white supremacy.
Can you give a few examples of how scholars have what you write, quote, buried the truth about presidents?
What comes to mind first is Buchanan. He came to office shortly before the Dred Scott decision was handed down. And it's usually mentioned as sign of a coincidence. He's the one who became president at that moment. But in reality, before he was inaugurated, he unethically, improperly colluded with the justices on their decision regarding Dred Scott, who was suing. He argued he had been in non-slave territory and he should have been freed. And the court was going to rule narrowly that he did not have a right to be free. But Buchanan wanted a decision that not only would say that he wasn't free, but that would deprive black people of any rights whatsoever. It was an effort to stamp out the growing abolitionist movement. So you can't talk about the Dred Scott case and talk about Buchanan without talking about the fact that he put his thumb on the scale. There were letters between him and the justices. So we have to talk about this ruling which said black people had, even those who were free, had no rights at all, none that a white man need respect. But this came about precisely because a president worked behind the scenes with the Supreme Court to make that so.
Margaret Kimberly, this is good stuff. Give us another example, would you please?
Oh, sure. You know, the fact that this capital city was created, we're told, and it is somewhat true that Alexander Hamilton made a deal that the Federal Reserve would be in New York and the new government would pay the Revolutionary War debts, and that's why the money's in New York and the capital is somewhere else. But there was something else going on. There was no need to build a new city. There were already cities, population centers conveniently located on the coast. Why would you build a new city on a swamp? Well, the purpose was to make sure that the capital was safely located in the territory that depended on the plantation economy. And that is why the city of Washington was built. The capital was first in New York, where Washington was inaugurated, then moved further south to Philadelphia, and then they built an entirely new city between Maryland and Virginia. And the purpose of that was to protect the slaveholding powers.
When Washington was president, the capital was in Philadelphia. Washington held slaves. Was that a problem for Washington?
It certainly was, because in Pennsylvania, any enslaved person who stayed in the state for more than 6 months was freed. So Washington simply rotated the enslaved people between Philadelphia and Mount Vernon and made sure none of them were in the state for 6 months. And that was illegal, because the law in Pennsylvania prevented that loophole from happening. But he ignored it, and after all, he was the president. Who was going to stop him from doing it? So yes, it was quite corrupt. Also, he profited personally from the building of a capital that was so close to his estate at Mount Vernon.
You know, that reminds me of the movie Harriet, where Harriet Tubman was from Maryland, which borders Pennsylvania. And if you got to Pennsylvania from Maryland, you were home free. And that's portrayed in the movie. Did you see the movie?
I did not see the movie. But that all ended with there was always a Fugitive Slave Act provision. It was in the Constitution. The law that came into being in 1851 not only said that those who escaped had to be returned, but it deputized anyone at all to help return them, deprived the people fleeing of their rights, required anyone who was asked to assist in the removal of that person. So even those states above the Mason-Dixon line became unsafe for those who were fortunate enough to be close to the border and managed to escape.
Margaret, most of the initial presidents of the U.S. were slaveholders from Virginia. Mm-hmm. Do you excuse them in the manner commonly offered that they were, quote, products of their times?
I do not, because there were people at that time who questioned the morality of the slave system. There was a man named Kosciuszko. I think it's Tadeusz, I hope I'm not mispronouncing his name, Polish soldier and nobleman who fought on the side of the Americans in the Revolutionary War. He left money, and he was a slaveholder. He freed those people. And he had many conversations with Thomas Jefferson about ending enslavement. And Jefferson always complained about money. And Kosciuszko left him money in his will to give to Jefferson so that he could compensate himself and free the enslaved people that he held. Well, he did die, and he left Jefferson the money, but Jefferson never did it. And the will was tied up in court for many years, but the point of the story is that there were people who questioned slavery at that time, so it isn't an excuse. There is another man who was Jefferson's secretary, and he and Madison and Jefferson, he worked for, he freed his enslaved people. He took them to Illinois and freed them there. So this did come up. It's not an excuse. And you could excuse just about anything in history if you want to, but we don't want to. And there's been too much excusing, and that's been quite a problem in American history.
Margaret, can you please talk about Theodore Roosevelt as, quote, a rough rider and Andrew Jackson as a, quote, Indian fighter? What is the truth behind these romantic representations?
Well, the truth behind, first of all, the fact that there are romantic representations of these people is the central problem. But Roosevelt was openly racist, a white supremacist. He called black people a thoroughly stupid race. He often spoke of the need for white people to have more babies. He literally said these things. He was an imperialist. He stole Panama from Colombia in order to build the Panama Canal. And he, one of the worst things he ever did, there was a group of black soldiers in Brownsville, Texas, who, when they were attacked by a white mob, fought back. And Roosevelt imprisoned some of them for very long terms, revoked their commissions, took away their benefits, and he did it after Election Day, because at that time, the Republicans, the party of Lincoln, was the party that got black votes. So he waited till after Election Day to carry out this act. Andrew Jackson is, and people often ask me who I think is the worst, and I pick Andrew Jackson. He is the one who enacted all of the goals of expansion, of eradicating the indigenous population. He is the one who carried out the Indian Removal Act, the ethnic cleansing of indigenous people from the Southeast, in order to expand and grow the plantation economy. So all the southern states, Georgia and Alabama and the Carolinas and Tennessee, all of them, Mississippi, they were called the five civilized tribes. He pushed them all out. He fought the British and the Spanish. There was still some European presence on what's now the United States. Florida belonged to Spain. He nearly started a war with Spain in order to kick them out. The Battle of New Orleans, we're told in school that he didn't realize the War of 1812 had ended. He knew, but his goal was to make sure that the British stayed out. So he seized land for the plantation economy. He practiced genocide against the indigenous people in order to do it, and he was a slaveholder himself. He owned at least 200 people. So he gets my vote as the worst.
Yeah, and slaves were quite valuable, of course. I read that a slave was worth about $50,000 in those days. It was the gift that kept on giving. There was no reason to emancipate them because they kept churning out profits for their owner. We're speaking with Margaret Kimberly, who wrote the terrific new book, just came out, was launched yesterday, called Prejudicial, Black America and the Presidents. Margaret, were Lincoln, FDR, and Clinton much better, more sympathetic to the interests of black Americans?
Well, they weren't. Lincoln was not an abolitionist. The Republican Party was founded in order to stop the expansion of slavery into the Western territories, not to end it. Lincoln was pushed into making the Civil War a war for slavery when enslaved people freed themselves at every opportunity and escaped to Union lines. He always wanted, he never gave up hope of sending black people out of the country. These schemes referred to as colonization were talked about very seriously for many decades. He had a colonization office in his administration. He actually carried out one plan. It was did not last very long, where several hundred people were sent to a place called Isla Vache, Cow Island off the coast of Haiti. He, as late as a week before he was assassinated, he spoke to a former Union general, Benjamin Butler, about coming up with a plan to send black people out of the country. As far as FDR is concerned, the New Deal was groundbreaking. That is true. He's the one who established that the federal government should play a role in our everyday lives. But at that time, the Democratic Party was the party of the Southern segregationist. And FDR, that was always his excuse for not doing more. My hands are tied. I can't do anything because so anti-lynching legislation was never passed, So despite many pleas for him to do something, he never did. And that was always his excuse. There were programs such as the Social Security Act. While it helped many workers, it excluded farm work and excluded domestic work, and that is what most black people did at that time. Bill Clinton built his campaign on many racist tropes. There was the sister soldier moment, which he used to embarrass Jesse Jackson and make it clear that he was going to be the white people's president. He left the campaign trail to execute a mentally disabled black man. He did things like he is the one who brought us neoliberal policies. That is the moment when the Democrats established that they were going to be the party of corporate interests as much as the Republicans. So he is the one who deregulated financial services. He is the one who used the term welfare reform to basically eviscerate what FDR had established for 60 years. We had a right to request public assistance. And his welfare reform bill put millions of people in poverty. So those are the kinds of things that Clinton did. He also, one of the most disgraceful things he did during his campaign, he had this photo op in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Stone Mountain is the place where the Ku Klux Klan was celebrated and brought reestablished in the early 20th century. It's the site of a Confederate monument. Clinton went to a prison there and used black men in prison garb as his photo opportunity, just in case anyone had any idea that he might be a non-racist, non-white supremacist president. So those are some of the examples of these people. And I, you know, they're presidents who are thought of as being quote-unquote good for black people, but I make the argument in the book that there is no such thing. They are bad and less bad.
Well, Margaret, speaking of bad, who were the least bad presidents?
Well, the ones who were the least bad were the ones who responded to demands from mass movements. So Lyndon Johnson, for example, he did shepherd through the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. But at the time, there was a movement involving millions of people, and that is what forced his hand. So he should not get too much credit for having done the right thing. FDR, going back to FDR, he signed some, you know, rather tepid civil rights legislation, but that's because A. Philip Randolph threatened a march on Washington. So these laws, which impacted mostly the defense industries during the war, were meant to prevent discrimination against black workers. They did to some degree, but again, it was the demand from the people that forced him to do it.
We're speaking with Margaret Kimberly, author of Prejudicial, Black America and the Presidents. It just came out yesterday. It's a terrific book. We encourage everybody to go out and get it and read it. It's 45 chapters on 45 different presidents. I suppose you could say one worse than the next. But in any case, a brilliant expose, a real hidden history of America's shameful past. And we encourage people to go out and get it. Margaret, black people cling to one party. Initially, it was the Republicans, and now the Democrats. Why is this so?
Well, in this country, there's one party becomes a de facto white people's party. And that means black people are forced into the other one. And as you point out, those roles switched. But it's very dangerous for us because it leads to passivity. We're seeing it again this year. Black politics now consists of just keeping Republicans out of office. And so instead of having demands about what we want and for us as a group to state what we need to see, you see it now where we're told that so-and-so is more electable, that is to say, can defeat Trump. So we are trapped in this party that needs our vote but wishes it did not need our votes. So they don't protect the franchise. We're still seeing vote purges. We don't see any activity in the Democratic Party because of it. And this, the concept of lesser evilism, it leads to often to us accepting racists like Bill Clinton was. Jimmy Carter, I don't know if you recall, he made a remark about the ethnic purity of neighborhoods, but he got the Democratic nomination, so he still got 90% of the black vote. I think we do have options. I think our option is to think of self-determination. Our option is to sometimes stay out. If the Democrats believe our support is so anathema to them, then we have to stay out sometimes. And these are, you know, there are endless debates about this, but not enough debate, in my opinion, in order for us to see ourselves as these supplicants, where it was for years it was the Republicans, and no matter what they did, we hoped they would protect us from the segregationist Democrats, and the past 50 years or so, clinging to the Democrats and hoping and hopes that they would protect us from Republicans. That kind of strategy led to, look, Trump is in office. So all that, the decision on the part of black leaders or misleaders, as we call them at Black Agenda Report, to herd us into Hillary Clinton's tent, and we ended up with Trump anyway, and overt racist.
Margaret, you've said that our first black president, Barack Obama, was chosen by the capitalist ruling class, and that all we got out of Obama is, quote, happiness. What did you mean by that, and what did Obama do?
Well, he continued the neoliberal policies of Bill Clinton and other Democrats. He is the one who bailed out the banks, gave the banks trillions of dollars, while black people, the people, by the way, the financial services industry was responsible for the financial collapse in 2008. Black people, who the little wealth that most of us have, it lies in our homes. People lost their homes. There was no bailout for us, and you can see it now. He's getting paid $500,000 to give speeches, but He always denied being president, despite the love shown to him. In his 2004, his maiden speech, so to say, he at the Democratic National Convention, he was running for the Senate in Illinois, and he said during his speech, "There is no black America, there is no white America." Well, that's simply not true. There definitely is a black America, but that was a signal, that was a sign. He was making it clear he was not going to try to resurrect black politics, that is to say, black people having our own political agenda that meets our needs. And he always, during his whole time in office, if he was ever asked about black people, he gave the same canned answer: a rising tide lifts all boats. So if we have good economic policies and employment goes up, it goes up for everybody. And that's all he ever wanted to say. He also engaged in racist tropes. The constant scolding, particularly of black men, was something that a white person would not have been able to get away with. I think that was both a political and personal issue. I'll be an amateur psychologist, and I believe when he sees black men, he sees the father who abandoned him. That's my 2 cents worth of psychology. But even his signature achievement, Obamacare, that was a bailout of Big Pharma and the insurance companies. But what little he did has been undone by Trump, so it was all pretty hollow. But despite the fact that he went out of his way to say that he was not going to be the black people's president, he was still and is still and probably always will be loved very much.
Keep your psychologist hat on for a second, Margaret Kimberly. What do you think of Trump?
Okay. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I think Trump's election is completely the fault of the Democratic Party. He squeaked through in the Electoral College because he was racist. He got new voters out. He got 2 million more votes than Mitt Romney did. And Hillary Clinton also encouraged, lest we forget, she encouraged her friends in the corporate media to promote him because she thought he would be easiest to beat. Instead, his racism is what made him attractive, and he was able to peel votes away from her. He is the one who said he wanted the Republican Party to be the workers' party. That is supposed to be a Democratic Party line. And then, of course, she didn't even bother with the get-out-the-vote effort that everybody must. She raised $1 billion and then couldn't get 10,000 more votes in Michigan, for example. So Trump is, I believe he has a good chance to win again because the Democratic Party is focused on stopping Bernie Sanders and not on building a campaign against him. The people who voted for Trump the first time don't have any reason not to vote for him a second time. So I think he is poised to be reelected, and the Democrats give in to him. I understand Nancy Pelosi tore up his speech, but she and the Democrats gave him his border wall, gave him his Space Force, gave him the military spending he requested, gave him his trade deals. And so the Democrats are complicit in what he does. They give lip service about denying him what it is he wants. But once again, we see a successful Republican president, and it's because the Democratic Party is complicit.
When Trump introduced Guaido, the self-appointed president of Venezuela, he called the democratically elected president of Venezuela, Maduro, a vicious socialist dictator. And when he said that, Nancy Pelosi was standing right behind him, stood up and clapped. So she may have torn up his speech, but she agreed with part of it. Margaret, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately. What would it take to bring about fundamental social change in the USA?
I think we have to do something revolutionary. And that word is scary to people. They have images of violent uprising. But we must get rid of the Democratic Party. They are a bigger problem, I believe, in bringing about change than the Republicans are. I was a Democrat most of my life. I'm a member of the Green Party now. We must build a left-wing party. And I think we have to be, Americans have to relearn mass action. As I mentioned, the liberation movement of the 60s, which was followed by very large movements, the environmental movement. There were millions of people in the streets, and a Republican president started the EPA as a result. So that's the kind of thing we need. I think this year we're poised to get it because I think what the Democrats are trying to do is going to lead to a break in the Democratic Party. I think many progressives are finally going to be through with the Democrats, and that is going to be a good thing. And we can start talking about how to do things that are truly transformational to improve our country.
We've been speaking with Margaret Kimberly, the author of the new book, Presidential, Black America and the Presidents. Margaret, how can people follow your work and get your book?
Sure, you can follow my work at blackagendareport.com. I'm on Twitter at freedomrideblog. And my book is available from Amazon and also directly from the publisher, Steerforth Press, so steerforthpress.com.
I hope people...
And I'm on Patreon, patreon.com/Margaret Kimberly.
Margaret, it's been a real pleasure for Heidi and I to have you on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much. Every success with your new book. Sorry to have to let you go, but we'll have you back on again, hopefully sooner rather than later. You take it easy and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Increasing numbers of women and men are putting off marriage until they're older. Many are foregoing it altogether.
In Denmark, for example, among women in their late 30s or early 40s, 29% are unmarried. That's true for 18% in Italy, 22% in Lebanon, and 32% in Libya. That's why the following statistic is so shocking. Each year, before they reach the age of 18, 12 million girls will marry. It happens in every country and cuts across religious, ethnic, and cultural divides. Over 650 million women alive today were married as girls. Child marriage is actually a human rights violation. It places girls' well-being and personal development at risk. Child brides are often isolated and feel disempowered. They're deprived of their fundamental rights to health, education, and safety. Children aren't physically or emotionally ready to become wives and mothers. They also have heightened health risks, from life-threatening complications in pregnancy and childbirth to being victims of domestic violence or of contracting HIV/AIDS. They have limited access to education and economic opportunities and a higher chance of living in poverty. Joining us today to talk about child marriage is activist Freddy Reese. Freddy is the founder and executive director of Unchained at Last. The nonprofit helps girls and women plan escapes from forced marriages and then rebuild their lives. Freddy Reese, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Freddy, let's start by defining child marriage. What is it?
A child marriage is one in which one or both parties is under the age of 18.
And are we usually talking about girls marrying or being forced to marry older men?
Well, a child marriage can involve a girl or a boy or someone who's genderqueer. However, when we look at the data in the United States, based on the groundbreaking research that Unchained at Last did, we know that almost all of the children who marry in the United States are girls married to adult men. And globally, too, we know that this is very much a girls' issue. This is almost always happening to girls.
Why haven't we heard more about this in the news?
That's a really good question. I've been working really hard to change that, and we at Unchained at Last are doing everything we can to bring to national awareness the fact that child marriage remains a significant problem in the United States. It's a big country, and there are a lot of people here, 350 million people, so we're every day, if you go to our website, we're involved in events and protests every day to try to raise the public consciousness about this, and we're going to continue doing that, and so I appreciate your pointing your spotlight on it today.
How does the U.S. rank in terms of child marriages or unions?
There are two aspects to that. There are the laws themselves, and then there's how often this is happening. So when we look at the laws themselves, the United States, unfortunately, is lagging behind a lot of other countries where there are stronger laws to prevent child marriage from happening. However, in a lot of other countries, even where there are strong laws, there is lack of enforcement, and so child marriage remains a prevalent problem. In a country like India, for example, where child marriage is pervasive, even though technically under the law, a child is not allowed to marry in India. So here in the U.S., the problem is the laws themselves. In 48 U.S. states, the law still allows marriage before the age of 18, and in the other two states, Delaware and New Jersey, the law allowed it just until 2018, and it only changed because of our advocacy here at Unchained at Last. When we look at how pervasive a problem it is, we know, again, only based on Unchained at Last's original groundbreaking research, that between 2000 and 2010, an estimated 248,000 children were married in the United States. They were as young as 12, almost all of them girls married to adult men. Now, that figure, while staggering, does not put United States at the top of the list in terms of the rate of child marriage. A lot of countries around the world have an even more staggering rate of child marriage. But it's still a really, really alarming number that nobody can ignore. And we need to solve this problem, and we can easily.
Freddy, can child brides seek divorce?
Well, that's one of the really horrific aspects of child marriage, and there are so many. The two main reasons that we at Unchained at Last are determined to end child marriage are, one, because it can so easily be forced, and it's exactly what you were saying just now. Can a child file for divorce? In many cases, no. Typically, before the age of 18, across the United States, children have limited legal rights. So our argument is not about maturity, it's about legal capacity. Before the age of 18, it's really difficult, if not impossible, for a child to leave home, to escape from an abusive spouse, get into a domestic violence shelter, retain an attorney because contracts with children typically are avoidable, or even bring a legal action, and that in many states includes a divorce. In many states, children can be entered into a marriage by their parents or a judge, but then don't have the legal right to get out of that marriage. So they're disempowered throughout the process of entering the marriage and then trapped in it until they become legal adults. And by the way, the second really important reason to end child marriage is because even when it's not forced, there are such devastating lifelong repercussions for girls in the U.S. who marry before 18 that the U.S. State Department calls child marriage or marriage before 18 a human rights abuse.
And we wanted to talk about that because the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that, quote, marriage shall be entered into only when with the free and full consent of the intending spouses. Talk a bit about the human rights violations in child marriages.
So there are two aspects of that. There are two ways that a child marriage is a human rights abuse. One is that it's so easily forced. And it's, as I was saying before, where children just have limited legal rights. So if you are a child, even if you're 17 and turning 18 tomorrow, it's very difficult for you to either say no to parents who are planning a wedding for you that you don't want or to get out of a marriage you are already in because you don't have the rights to, in many cases, and it varies across the U.S., but typically you're not allowed to leave home, get into a domestic violence shelter, retain an attorney, bring a legal action in your own name, which includes a divorce or a protective order if you find yourself in an abusive marriage. The second reason that child marriage is a human rights abuse is because of the devastating lifelong repercussions. That's what the U.S. State Department points out when it calls child marriage a human rights abuse. And what we know is, globally, child marriage has devastating lifelong repercussions. But if we look just at the United States, forget what happens in a developing country when a girl marries before 18. Right here in the U.S., a girl or a woman who marries at or before 18 is 50% more likely to drop out of high school, 4 times less likely ever to finish college, 3 times more likely to have 5 or more children, 31% more likely to end up living in poverty, and then because of the forfeited education and the poverty and the stress, also face a 23% increased risk of heart attack, cancer, diabetes, stroke, an increased risk of almost every psychiatric disorder. And then globally, women who marry before 18 are also 3 times more likely to be physically assaulted by their spouse. So almost every aspect of a girl or a woman's life is destroyed if she marries before the age of 18.
We're speaking with Frady Rees, who's the executive director of Unchained at Last. Frady, the problem with these child marriages also extends into communities, doesn't it? And how is that so?
Well, so there's very little research done on who are the children in the U.S. who are marrying. The original research that we at Unchained at Last did, we retrieved marriage license data from across the U.S., and that's how we discovered that almost 250,000 children were married in the first decade of this millennium. But that research, for the most part, did not include identifying information about the children. So it's really hard to look at that data and know, are they all coming from or are a lot of them coming from a specific community or background or culture? Anecdotally, though, we do know, based on those who have reached out to us to say, this happened to me, can you help me? We know, based on that this is happening everywhere. There is no one community we can point to and say, that's where child marriage is happening. We at Unchained have seen it in every major religion, minor religions, secular backgrounds. We have seen it at every socioeconomic level. We have seen it in families that have been in the United States for many generations, as well as immigrant families from countries of origin on every inhabited continent. The commonality that we see, well, from the data, we know that most of the children who marry in the United States are age 16 or 17. So while marriage, even younger than that, marriage as young as zero is still legal in a lot of the United States, most of the children who marry are age 16 or 17, and they get very little sympathy from legislators, even though they are still children with all the limited legal capacity of children, and marriage at that age is still devastating for women and girls. And the other commonality that we see just anecdotally is that the perpetrators are almost always the parents. So it's not strangers grabbing girls off the street and forcing them to marry, it's their own parents.
Frady, you mentioned legislators. Is there legislation being introduced in the U.S. to stop this practice?
Yeah, we at Unchained are determined to solve this problem as a very simple legislative solution. There are a lot of problems out there where you can talk about how depressing it is and how upsetting it is, and there's nothing that we can do that we can to easily solve the problem. With child marriage, there is an easy legislative fix. Almost every state already sets 18 as the marriage age, but right now every state allows loopholes under which the effective marriage age is reduced, in many cases, all the way to zero. But in 48 states and in still three U.S. territories, it's allowing children to marry under some circumstances. And so what we have been pushing for is every state to pass legislation that eliminates those dangerous loopholes and keeps the marriage age at 18, which is the age of adulthood and the age at which we allow individuals to enter into almost any other contract. And we have succeeded already in Delaware, New Jersey, in helping to pass this legislation. We just had a legislative victory a couple weeks ago in the U.S. Virgin Islands, where they passed this legislation. American Samoa on its own, we were not even involved in this process. American Samoa passed the same legislation also recently, and now we have 48 states, three territories, and the District of Columbia left to pass the legislation. That's all. Yeah. No big deal.
Afraid if anyone can do it, you can.
Well, thank you. We like to think so, and we're doing everything we can to try to make that happen within our lifetimes, and we can
yes,
do it.
Yes, and I think our listeners will be really interested in this topic, and hopefully some will get involved. Frady, I wanted to note that on Law and Disorder, we have done several segments on the severe penalties in this country for possession of child pornography, with the sex offender registry being sometimes overly punitive. It seems incongruous to me that we don't have laws banning child marriage when we have such harsh punishment for individuals who may accidentally or tangentially be involved in something that seems damaging to children. Is that a disconnect in your mind?
Well, absolutely, that is a disconnect. That's a significant disconnect. But when you look at the laws, there are so many disconnects. There are so many other laws that are incongruous when you look at them next to the child marriage laws. And one of the big ones that we talk about a lot is the statutory rape laws. So what we have is, in most states, marriage is a specific exception under statutory rape laws. So what would otherwise be considered rape, in many cases felony rape, becomes completely legal once a marriage license is handed out. And so in that case, we're incentivizing predators to force children to marry so that they can legally rape these children. And in a lot of other states, in fewer, most states it is an exception, but still a lot of states, marriage is not an exception under the statutory rape laws. So we're creating this ridiculous situation where a marriage is legal, but every time the couple has sex, the adult spouse is committing rape, and it's making a mockery of our statutory rape laws. So yes, when you look at child marriage laws, and you look at it next to all kinds of other laws, some of which you may agree with, some of which you may not, none of it seems to make sense.
Please talk, Frady, about your organization, Unchained at Last. Do you provide legal support and related services for girls and women who escape?
Yeah, so when I first founded Unchained at Last, I founded it out of my own traumatic experience. I'm a forced marriage survivor. Our initial mission was specifically to provide direct services to individuals in the United States, mostly women and girls. Well, at first we thought it would be women who are either facing an impending forced marriage or already in one and need support to get out. And we provide really extensive, comprehensive, often life-saving services, legal and social services, everything from helping helping these individuals to escape, to, as you said, providing free legal representation and emotional support and psychotherapy and really any other service that they might need to help them get out of their bad situation and achieve emotional and financial independence. We never charge for any of our services. It's always free. But because more and more girls under the age of 18 were reaching out to us to ask for the same help that we were providing to adults 18 or older, and we realized there's almost nothing we can do. In addition to the fact that, before the age of 18, children typically are not even allowed to leave home or file for divorce, there's also the additional aspect in many states, if we as advocates help a child to leave home, we could be charged criminally. And that actually happened in one of the cases that we worked on. One of our volunteers was charged criminally for helping a girl who was facing a forced marriage. And that's why we took on this other little project. In our spare time, we have decided we need to change the laws in the United States to end child marriage, because the way the laws are written now, there's almost nothing we can do for a child who is in or facing a forced marriage. And in fact, what happens in many of these cases is that these girls, after they reach out and learn how limited their options are, end up turning to suicide attempts or self-harm, because that seems to them to be the only way out.
Frady, you have a remarkable personal story that you briefly alluded to. Would you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. So I grew up in New York City, and but it was in a very insular religious community where forced marriage and child marriage are very much the norm. And so my family arranged my marriage for me when I was 19 with very little input from me. It was to a stranger who turned out to be violent. And then, unfortunately, the way it works is often when somebody is forced into a marriage, that person, when someone has little or no choice about entering a marriage, that person typically has little or no choice about leaving the marriage. And that was certainly the case for me, where I had, in the community that I grew up in, I had no reproductive rights, was required to have unprotected sex with my husband. So my first child was born 11 months after my wedding. Pretty soon I had two kids. I had no financial rights, very limited legal rights. And in fact, in the community where I grew up, did not even have the legal right to end my own marriage. In that community, only a man is allowed to grant a divorce, not a woman. And so I was trapped for 15 years in my abusive marriage. And it was when I finally managed to escape with my two daughters, my family retaliated against me by shunning me. They still, more than a decade later, consider me dead.
Frady, I read that you developed a 5-year plan for escape.
That's correct. So, getting out of a situation like that is extremely difficult, which is why I founded Unchained at Last, because I know how difficult it was for me to get out, and I know others are in that situation. So for me, at 27, I put a plan in place to get out that turned out to be a 5-year plan, during which I got my college degree. I became the first person in my family to go to college, went to Rutgers University in New Jersey, where we were living at the time. And during that time, also saved up cash in the only place in the house where my then husband would not look, because he would look through all my personal belongings, down to the pockets of my skirts hanging in the closet, to show me that he owned me and he owned everything I owned. So the only place in the house where I could save up cash was a box of whole grain total in the pantry closet, and saved up more than $40,000 in that box of cereal over 5 years.
Whoa.
Frady, that's a remarkable story. What an inspiration you must be to the girls that you help.
Well, I hope so. And so for me, there's nothing perhaps as empowering as being able to turn your own trauma into a force for good and into a way to help others in that same trauma. And I do find that there's a real connection with the survivors who reach out when I'm able to share with them that I've been through this myself and share my own experience and show them there is a way out. As difficult, as daunting as it seems, it is possible. And so that's one of the beautiful things at Unchained is being able to make those connections with other people from many, many different cultures and backgrounds who are in the same situation now.
Frady Reese, you run the organization Unchained at Last. Can you tell us about one or two success stories that you've had?
Well, I couldn't share any particular story without first getting permission, but just generally speaking, I can say one of the most really remarkable experiences that we've had here at Unchained is after we pass legislation in a state, hearing about the specific lives that we have directly impacted with the new legislation. And so, in fact, just a couple weeks ago here at Unchained, we got a call from a youth advocate who was working with a client who had just been referred to her, a 16-year-old girl who was pregnant, and her supervisor was saying, please hurry, get in touch with this girl right away, see if you can get through to her. Her father is about to do what every, you know, parents often do in this situation, which, you know, because he finds it shameful that she's pregnant, he's going to force her to marry. And she told her supervisor, well, that's not legal anymore in New Jersey. He cannot do that. And her supervisor said, no, with parental consent, you can marry at 16 in New Jersey. And she said, no, that's not true anymore. Thanks to Unchained at Last, that cannot happen. And she called us. She happened to be aware of our organization and knew about this. And she called and said, just so you know, this is one more life that you just saved.
Freddie, you obviously involve volunteers in your work. Can you tell listeners who might be interested in learning more or even helping out how they can get involved?
Sure. I urge everybody to go to unchainedatlast.org. We always have events and protests coming up. There's a form of protest that we invented called the chain-in. People donate their bridal gowns to us so that we can gather in bridal gowns and veils, and we chain our wrists and tape our mouths, and we'll stand in a state house or state capitol or at Union Square or in New York or outside Newark Penn Station in New Jersey and just show legislators and the public this is what life looks like for a girl or a woman who is forced to marry. And our next chain-in is Valentine's Day chain-in in Minnesota. It's going to be on February 13th in St. Paul, and I hope people will join us. We provide the bridal gowns. It's an incredible experience to be able to do this and to be able to protest this human rights abuse that destroys girls' lives. We also have a lot of other upcoming events that I hope everybody will check out on our website. And we often have calls to action. There's a specific legislator in a specific state who's holding up the bill to end child marriage, and we'll post it on our website and send out an e-blast saying, please call or email this legislator. And we hope that people will join our email list and follow us on social media so they'll be aware when we have these calls to action and they can join the national movement to end child marriage.
Freddie Michael and I have a lot of experience through our work with the National Lawyers Guild in protest, and I certainly applaud your using creativity in having the wedding gowns, because that really sends a striking message, as you know, to not only legislators but to the public at large. Announce one more time your website, please.
Sure. It's unchainedatlast.org. And by the way, if you have a bridal gown that's taking up room in your closet and you want to put it to good use, please consider donating it to us at Unchained at Last. We can give you a tax-deductible receipt, and we will put it to good use working to end child marriage and forced marriage in the United States.
Well, I can't think of a better use for a wedding gown, Freddie.
I got married at City Hall. And we didn't have bridal gowns then, at least not for my wife. But recently, friends of mine got married at City Hall. And now at City Hall in New York City, they sell baseball hats. And the men's baseball hat says groom, and the woman's baseball hat has a veil on it.
That's funny.
Well, you know what? Feel free to donate your baseball cap as well. We will find some creative way to put those to good use.
Michael and I will definitely check out any actions that happen here in New York. And again, we will put all this information on lawanddisorder.org. We want to both thank you for the really amazing and fearless work that you're doing and the many lives that you're impacting.
Well, I want to thank you for shining a spotlight on it. And, yeah, we couldn't do this work without this type of awareness raising. So thank you for caring about this issue and helping others to care about it and know about it as well.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Heidi Boghossian and me, Michael Smith, of Law & Disorder Radio, want to invite all of our listeners to a very important program on February 15th from 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 5 o'clock called The Prosecution of Julian Assange, His Right to Publish, Our Right to Know. It's happening at the CUNY Law School in Queens, 2 Court Square. The 7 train, the E train, the G train all go right there. The panel discussion includes Jim Goodale, the former general counsel of the New York Times who handled the Pentagon Papers case, Glenn Ford, the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, Max Blumenthal, the editor of The Gray Zone, and international human rights attorney Renata Avila. And we have video contact with Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and Alice Walker. 2 o'clock, February 15th, help defend Julian Assange. It's the most important civil liberties case, First Amendment case of our times. Hope to see you there.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.